let's go ahead and jump right into it. If folks can start on slide one, advanced design application and data analysis for field portable X-ray fluorescence. Again, you're attending the Cluin platform. And I'm Steve Diamond. I'm with the Office of Superfund Remediation Technology Innovation, Technology Innovation Field Services Division. And this is a seminar series that's based on our 8-hour course that we've developed. And this course was developed in a direct response to a number of EPA regional requests for technical support for triad projects, and particularly those utilizing X-ray fluorescence. And so actually what we did is we took the 8-hour course that we've developed and turned it into a series of 2-hour sessions, which we are presenting on the Cluin platform here in the month of August. So we're actually jokingly referring to August as XRF month here in the Cluin studios. But essentially, we've taken a one-day training course and presented it into 8 2-hour sessions. And we developed this course basically after reviewing numerous work plans, quality assurance project plans, and other planning documents at the request of EPA regions and other folks. And in doing so, it became apparent to us that this course would really benefit a variety of audiences. So we're looking to target technical folks, regulators, contractors, QA staff, and others. And for those who aren't aware, again, this is sort of came out of our triad support mechanism, and triad just quickly is an approach or a framework for decision-making as part of a hazardous waste site characterization and remediation. As the figure indicates, there's 3 legs of triad: systematic planning, dynamic work strategies, and, of course, real-time measurements. Obviously, XRF is a real-time measurement tool and is actually critical in the use of dynamic work strategies and other things that really lend their strength from the use of these real-time measurements. So that's going to be the gist of this series of eight two-hour seminars here in the month of August. And again, you can use a tool like this, and we'll look at the relationship of XRF to systematic planning and its impact on dynamic work strategies. So although it's a real-time measurement tool, it does have significant impacts to the other 2 legs of the triad. Go ahead and move to slide 2. Just quickly, again, some logistics. There is a question button on the Cluin page. You can go ahead and click on that button and type in questions as we go. The way we're going to do it for this series of seminars is if we can answer it immediately, we will do so. We also have a half hour of each successive session dedicated to more in-depth exploration of questions from the previous session. And then the 8th session will also be a wrap-up of all of those. And folks are going to need to control the slides themselves, so we'll try to remind you what slide we're on, but you're going to need to go ahead and manually forward or advance the slides. You can also look at review archive sessions, so there's going to be all of these sessions from this month will be archived at the website there that's on slide 1-2. That's cluin.org/archive. And also we'll provide you with some contact information for instructors. Let's go ahead and move to slide 3. Quickly, today's session is going to be a quick intro by myself, and then Dr. Robert Johnson, who I'll introduce in a moment, will introduce us to some XRF basics, so we're all kind of on the same page and up to speed in terms of the X-ray fluorescence lingo, and then we'll move from there. Moving on to slide 4, quickly an introduction. These are going to be the instructors for this series of seminars throughout the month of August. We have Dina Crumbling, and all of these folks here are instrumental in developing this course material that's taken from, you know, real-life application of XRF. It's taken from some of our technical support projects. So, again, quickly to introduce your instructors, Dina Crumbling is with me here in the Office of Superfund Remediation Technology Innovation. She's a chemist with over 25 years' experience, 12 of which have been in the waste cleanup industry. She worked for a state Superfund program and a consulting firm prior to joining EPA's Technology Innovation Program in 1997. She specializes in issues related to field analytical methods, sampling issues, statistics, and the triad approach. And you can see her contact information there. Robert Johnson is with us from Argonne National Lab, the Environmental Assessment Division. Dr. Johnson has worked at Argonne National Laboratory since 1991. as an environmental engineer, statistician, software developer, and project manager. He serves as a principal investigator and technical lead for Argonne's Adaptive Sampling and Analysis Program, or ASAP, and provides expert technical support to our office here on a number of triad-related training courses and projects. Bob has significant experience in statistical sampling design, as well as data analysis, interpretation, using XRF through his sites with DOE, EPA, DOD, and other technical support functions. And finally, Steve Diamond, that's me. I'm here again with the Office of Superfund Remediation Technology Innovation. I'm a chemist with 15 years experience, 4 in a commercial analytical laboratory setting, and 8 years in consulting. And I joined EPA in 2005 with a focus towards enhancing acceptance and the use of emerging analytical technologies and sampling strategies. So my perspective draws upon a number of years of practical laboratory and field experience as we try to apply EPA's triad approach and some of these real-time measurement technologies like XRF in programs like Superfund, Brownfields, RCRA, UST, and state programs. So my work has resulted in the development of a number of EPA case studies, profiles, and training courses that outline successful strategies for the use and understanding of collaborative data sets, adaptive quality control programs, and real-time analytics. I'd also like to thank Jeff Catanzarita with EPA's Emergency Response Team and Dennis Kalnicki with Lockheed Martin, who have also provided some additional support in the development of some of the materials that we'll be covering this month. So let's go ahead and move to slide 4. Excuse me. Who will benefit from this course? Again, this course was developed based on the huge variability that we saw in quality assurance project planning documents and other planning documents that we were asked to review. Terms like screening versus definitive data, various quality assurance and quality control applications, a variety of sampling designs, different ways to correlate lab data, and the use of collaborative information. So we saw a wide variety in all of these types of things, and it became apparent to us that both EPA regions, contractors, technical staff, QA staff, and others would really benefit from development of this course. So it was developed not only to assist triad practitioners and folks who are X-ray fluorescence users and enthusiasts, but also regulators and consultants developing planning documents, QA staff who are going to review those plans, and even end data users, folks like risk assessors and others. So our intent here was to highlight technical best practices, identify some potential pitfalls and other issues that we've observed at sites where we've used field portable XRF. Let's go ahead and move to slide 5. That's 6?
We're slide 6, yeah.
Slide 6, sorry. Couple of takeaway points. Again, these are some of the points that we'll be hammering on during the entire month. Again, it's XRF month here in the Kluwen Studios, and we're going to be hammering on these points throughout the month. Spatial heterogeneity. Dina will get into that in a fair amount of detail in the representativeness section. I'll talk a little bit more about that, but spatial heterogeneity is a primary source of data uncertainty, and it includes things like small-scale variability and even within sample variability. So we're talking about variability across small scales of inches or feet, but also even within the variability that can come within a cup or a bag or a glass jar that you might collect a sample in. And so we'll talk about all of those things. Traditional data strategies are often not cost-effective for addressing this data uncertainty because you really need a higher density to do so. And so that higher density and real-time information that's common with X-ray fluorescence can really provide a better strategy to deal with those uncertainties and the spatial heterogeneity and the small-scale variability, which can often have a huge impact on the success of your project. So we'll talk about that. And again, we're looking for try to use XRF in a more effective and efficient data designs as a dynamic, adaptive field decision-making tool. Again, it's a real-time data generation and management tool. And so we'll talk more about dynamic work strategy throughout the month and the use of adaptive field decision-making with X-ray fluorescence as the main tool to do that. And finally, the use of appropriate sampling designs, quality assurance, quality control, and collaborative data allow higher certainty in defensible decisions with XRF. And we're going to talk about defensibility and decisions that we feel you can make with XRF and where we think XRF as a technology is headed. In fact, when you consider many of the other real-time tools like test kits or direct sensing tools like laser-induced fluorescence or membrane interface probe, electrical conductivity, immunoassays, and others, XRF is actually really one of the best understood and most utilized tools in this category, yet we still struggle with attitudes of comments like, well, it's only a screening tool or it's only for lead. And through this series of seminars here in August, we really hope to open your eyes to the wide array of applications that we see for XRF. As we jokingly say, there's been a tremendous amount of improvement in the technology, so we jokingly say today's models are not your daddy's XRF. The newer models have miniaturized X-ray tubes, better detection limits, better software, better peak resolution, better batteries, and now these tools are being coupled with all sorts of fun applications, directly coupled with GPS, direct uploads, and a variety of other things. So if you have used XRF in years past, I would encourage you to revisit some of the newer models and look at some of the improvements in terms of detection limits and resolving peaks, dealing with interferences, and we'll talk about all of those during this course. So let's go ahead and move to slide 7. Quickly, I just want to go through the seminar sessions and the schedule for this month. Session 1. I'm going to be doing the intro here quickly, and then Bob will be jumping into covering some of the XRF basics today, things like theory of operation, how field-portable XRF units are often used, what they measure, calibration, performance, detection limits, and so on. And we'll do that today. And then this Thursday, August 7th, and the following Monday, August 11th, Dina will be helping us all wrestle with that devious and sometimes misunderstood concept of representativeness. And so her two sessions will focus on collection of representative samples, the idea of spatial variability, sample heterogeneity, the importance of sample support, things like the size, shape, and orientation of how you collect your sample, and the sources of uncertainty and variability that come along with that. And then we're going to try to provide some strategies to deal with those issues. And we'll follow that up on Thursday, August 14th, if we go ahead Okay. If we go ahead now, August 14th on Thursday, I'll be talking about demonstration of methods applicability, or DMA, specifically how it relates to X-ray fluorescence projects. So I'll be covering things like that initial site instrument or matrix-specific evaluation that you might do with your XRF instrument. And that DMA, in our mind, is really going to form the basis for the future of how you're going to operate the instrument, what sample design you might use, what your quality assurance and quality control procedures might be, your implementation of dynamic work strategies, and how you might use XRF collaboratively with things like laboratory analysis, such as inductively coupled plasma or atomic absorption or something like that. Then on Monday, August 18th, I'm going to try to take those DMA concepts and tie them back to a quality control practice or a series of quality control practices that you can then use in your sampling and analysis program to provide high-quality, defensible XRF data. So we'll explore the types of QC samples, the information they provide, some of the things you might want to watch out for when you're employing XRF at your site, and how XRF data can be used collaboratively with other sources of information. I'll just quickly, again, touch on the DMA concept. I actually did a two-hour Kluwin presentation last Monday, July 28th, on the DMA concept. It was a little bit broader to include other technologies beyond XRF, but that archive is available, and of course, you can go and review that. But I'm going to take a lot of those same concepts and apply those directly to X-ray fluorescence. For my portion on DMA. And then finally, in sessions 6 and 7, that'll be Thursday, August 21st, and Monday, August 25th, Bob is going to be rolling up all of these concepts and illustrating how XRF can be used to facilitate and drive dynamic work strategies, those adaptive learn-as-you-go techniques that can be so critical to efficient characterization and remediation efforts. So Bob will be looking at the critical role of conceptual site models and the impacts to sampling design, things like compositing, multi-incremental sampling strategies, strategies for controlling variability in things like cups or bags or in-situ operation with an XRF unit, all of this within the context of defining a decision unit, and Dina will get into that as well. And then we're going to be talking about developing decision rules or field-based action levels and providing strategies for how we're going to adaptively use analytics and field analytics, XRF, sampling techniques and analysis techniques to allow you to deal with the variability and heterogeneity as they are identified at your site in real time. Let's go ahead and move to slide 9. And finally, the Thursday, August 28th, that's going to be the wrap-up, if you will. That's going to be your all-star cast of instructors will return for a final in-depth Q&A session. So we're going to revisit as many of the more intriguing questions that we get during the series of seminars during that final session on August 28th. It's also a great opportunity to ask questions regarding sessions that if you're unable to attend all of these in the month of August, you might be able to ask some additional questions. And again, we'll try to probe some of those concepts more in depth if we think we're getting a number of questions regarding specifics. And that allows us a week to kind of prepare some slides and draw from some examples to illustrate some of the concepts that we're talking about. So that again is August 28th, and that's the wrap up for the month. So we'll provide some additional resources, some case studies, some triad profiles, some sampling guidance, and another look at some instrument evaluations and some other things that are available to you, and we'll do that again in that last session. Let's move to slide 10, session logistics. Quickly, each session will be about 2 hours long. You can either chat, send in your questions by email, or you can jump on the phone line and ask questions directly. Again, we'll try to answer those that we can initially or immediately, and those that we need to, we'll push back to the first half hour of the subsequent session, and we'll also try to, again, encompass all of these questions in the wrap-up. So that's how we're going to try to run this series of two-hour seminars and make it flow like a one-day course. Go ahead now and quickly, slide 11, the session breakouts. Again, presentation, answers to some questions, then we'll go through an hour and a half presentation for what the current session is, and we'll try to answer some of those questions. And again, session 8 will be the wrap-up. That's, I guess I've explained all of those things. And then finally, slide 12, this is our instrument and software disclaimer. Again, we realize that there are a number of X-ray fluorescence vendors out there. The focus of this course happens to be on the field portable applications, so those small handheld devices. But we recognize that there are specific vendors or instruments in some cases and some of the examples that are discussed. And we just want to make sure that folks are aware that this does not constitute an endorsement, but rather just provide some context to the specific applications that we've used to develop some of the course materials. We realize there are other manufacturers out there, and so we would encourage you to talk to manufacturers and try to find an instrument that can meet your needs. And likewise, in the case of software, we'll mention a variety of different data evaluation or visualization or decision support tools that we'll reference throughout this series. And we recognize that there are many freeware and proprietary alternatives or similar packages. So, again, we're providing examples of references, and that does not constitute an endorsement. We realize there's some really nice commercially available packages that we've used on a number of sites. We've also compiled information on a whole host of what we call freeware or free software capabilities, and those can be found at the link that you see at the bottom there. FRTR, Federal Remediations Technologies Roundtable.gov/decision support, and you can download a lot of the freeware decision support tools that we'll mention throughout this series. So with that, I'm going to turn things over to Bob Johnson, and let's go ahead and let XRF Month begin.
All right, thank you, Steve. Everyone should, on their screen, have slide 2-1 visible. This is the second module. This will take up the rest of today, and we're going to talk about basic XRF concepts. I'm going to pause at the end of each page or each slide and ask if there are questions, and I'll wait just a couple seconds before I move on. If you do have questions and you'd like to put them out at that point, feel free to do so. So let's go to the next slide, slide 2-2. And let's talk about XRF basics. An XRF The instrument that you take to the field basically has three fundamental components, and that is it has an X-ray source, it has a detector, and it has something to process the signals that the detector picks up. An X-ray source historically was a sealed source, a radionuclide such as americium 241 or something similar that emitted X-rays. More recent instruments have moved away from that and have gone towards electronic tube-based X-ray sources. But the principle is basically the same, and that is that the XRF irradiates a sample with X-rays. That sample, in response, emits characteristic X-rays, and those X-rays are characteristic of the elements that are inside that sample. So your XRF unit also then has a detector that picks up the X-rays coming off the sample, and then a signal processing unit that evaluates the energy level and the frequency of the various X-rays that are being produced. With that information, then, the XRF applies some mathematical algorithms and then can back calculate the concentrations of specific elements that are present. And those concentrations are based on fundamental sample assumptions. And that's an important point, and I'll come back to that a bit later. An XRF unit that has been calibrated, say, for a soil sample, looking for lead in the soil sample, will be set up differently than an XRF that's been calibrated for looking for lead in a swipe sample, or looking for lead in instrument components, for example. So even though the same instrument may be looking for the same element, given the context, the way it's been set up and the way it's been calibrated may be different. So those are that's the fundamentals of what an X-ray system or XRF system looks like. Other questions? So let's go to the next slide, 2-3. This is an example XRF spectrum that came off on a particular sample analysis. I put this up here for a couple of reasons, to illustrate a couple of things. First of all, along the x-axis, it's labeled KeV. And that, in fact, is a measure of the energy associated with the electrons coming, not with the electrons, with the X-rays coming off the sample that was irradiated. The y-axis is counting the number of X-rays that are being counted. So for any particular peak that's displayed here, you have an energy associated with it, and then its height indicates basically the frequency with which X-rays were encountered at that peak. Now, you notice that these peaks have labels, and a couple important points. I mean, if you look at the two biggest peaks to the right, you'll see they're both labeled lead. And in fact, any particular element may emit more than one characteristic X-ray when it's been irradiated. In this particular case, we see two peaks here for lead, one between 10 and 11 keV, one between 12 and 13 keV. The second point you'll notice is that for some of these elements, the peaks are so close together that you really can't tell the difference between the two. For example, about midway through the screen, or a little bit to the left of center, you'll see a high peak for nickel, and then just to the left of that, a lower peak for iron. Those peaks are so close together that the XRF can't resolve which is which. That's an important thing. That effect of when peaks overlap like that is known as interference. And we're going to be talking more about interference later on, but interference can be a factor in complicating the analysis, XRF analysis for certain elements. So but the important thing here is by looking at the characteristic energy levels where those peaks are located on the energy line, and at the height of the peak, an XRF unit can then back calculate how much mass or what the concentration is that's present for any particular element. Any questions about what you're looking at? Okay, then let's go on to slide 2-4. This is a benchtop XRF unit. In fact, XRF systems have been around a long time, and they've been used in a laboratory setting for doing very quantitative types of analyses for metals. A couple of things, and that is, first of all, an XRF is different, say, than an ICP analysis, in that an XRF is non-destructive. There is no extraction that's taking place from your sample. You're physically, in this particular case, taking the sample in a cup, placing it on top of the instrument, and doing the measurement. And you could do that measurement or repeat that measurement multiple times, but have no effect on the sample at all. And you'd get just multiple replicate measurements of that same sample. So in that context, among metals, XRF is distinctly different than, say, an ICP analysis. Questions? Let's go on to the next slide then, 2-5. The primary point of discussion, though, for this seminar is, in fact, handheld units, and those have been around for about the past 10 years. You see an example of a handheld unit in this slide. This particular case, it's an Intevax unit. The latest handheld units are about the size of an oversized drill, so they're not very large at all. And then often they'll come with a stand where they can be set up in a portable trailer or something like that where one might do an analysis. In this particular case, you see this instrument pointing up. The detector end is pointing up, and at the very top of the stand, you'll see a little white cup, and it's taking a measurement on that cup. On the table, you'll see other sample cups that have been prepared and are awaiting measurement. So this is one way a portable XRF can be used, almost like a lab instrument, set up to do measurements on prepared samples. Another way a portable XRF might be used, and I don't have a photograph of this that I can show you, but I can just talk you through it, is taking measurements of samples that have been bagged and then taking that measurement to the bag walls with very limited sample preparation. And we'll talk more about that in a little bit, but that is perfectly possible with an XRF unit. The third thing that you can do with an XRF unit is doing in-situ measurements of exposed surfaces. And if we could go to the next slide, 2-6, you'll see a photograph of that. In this particular case, this happens to be a Niton unit. The business end of this unit is pointing down toward the ground, and the gentleman here in the photograph is taking a measurement of metal concentrations in the exposed surface soils that are present there. One other thing that I neglected to mention about an XRF, but I'm going to emphasize here, and that is the business end of an XRF, handheld XRF unit, is only about the size of a postage stamp. That postage stamp size detector only sees the very top millimeter or two of the media that's presented to it, for example, soils. So when this gentleman is taking an XRF measurement of the exposed soil surface here, he's really only looking at metal concentrations in the topmost thin layer of soil sitting underneath that detector. So that detector in this particular case is not telling you what the concentrations are down at 3 inches or 6 inches or 12 inches. It's telling you what the concentrations are in the first couple of millimeters of soil sitting directly beneath it. And that's a very, very important point that we're going to come back to repeatedly throughout this course. And that is the amount of sample that's actually measured by an XRF is a very, very small, maybe a gram, 2 grams, 3 grams worth of soil. And that's all that it's actually seeing. Are there any questions about this so far? All right, then let's go on to slide 2-7. So what does an XRF typically report? At the bottom of your slide here, what you're looking at is basically a snapshot of output from an Intevax unit. If you had a Niton unit, you'd find that what you were looking at is very similar to this. They both present fundamentally the same types of information. In this little spreadsheet snapshot, is there a question that I can answer? Okay. In the snapshot of a spreadsheet, of course, in our first column there, we have the date the measurement's taken. Column C, it talks about the mode. This is important from the perspective of this instrument in that it's indicating what type of media the instrument's been calibrated for. In this particular case, most of these entries are soil entries, and that means the instrument's been set up to measure metal concentrations in soils. Column D is actually a very interesting column, and that is labeled lifetime. Typically, when we take an XRF measurement, the measurement time can range anywhere from just a few seconds, 10 seconds, 15 seconds, all the way up to about 600 seconds or 5 minutes. And that typically is the maximum amount of time one might acquire an XRF measurement. Now, with an Intevax unit, if you set the acquisition time for a specific period of time, like 120 seconds, the instrument will require for that absolute amount of time. But the actual time that the detector is live and acquiring information is somewhat less than that. So in this particular case, the acquisition time was set for 120 seconds, but the live time that we see here is running 76, 80, 76, 83, 83 seconds. So it's about, two-thirds, three-quarters of what the acquisition time was that the instrument was set up for. The reason I raise this point is that a Niton unit is slightly different. In a Niton unit, when you specify your acquisition time, really what you're specifying is the live time. And so when you say to a Niton unit, collect data for 120 seconds, it'll actually go longer than 120 seconds because it'll acquire data until it's had 120 seconds of live time. A small difference between the way an Intevac unit works and the way a Niton unit works. The next couple of columns that you see here have to do with instrument calibration, so I'm going to skip over those. But from columns O on, O, P, Q, R, S, T, we actually see analytical results. In this particular case, I have analytical results for three different elements, chromium, magnesium, and iron. A couple things to note here. With every element, there's not only the element result, but there's also an error that's reported, the plus or minus. So, for example, for chromium, if you look at row 14, the chromium result that's reported is 196 ppm, plus or minus 60 ppm. What that plus or minus is it's an estimate, it's an instrument estimate of the error associated with the measure, with the measurement that was just made. One standard deviation error. In the case of a Niton, you have a distinction between an Intevac and a Niton unit. In the case of a Niton unit, a Niton actually reports two standard deviation errors, not one standard deviation. So a Niton, everything else being equal, would appear to have twice as much error as Intevac has, but it's not the case. It's just a reporting error in slightly different ways. So think of that error as the approximate analytical quality associated with the measurement that's being reported. The next thing here that's important to point out is that for each element, there is a detection limit associated with the measurement being done. And when the XRF observes a result that it believes is below its detection limit, it won't report the result. It'll report it as a less than LOD. And you see some examples of that for chromium here. So, for example, row 13, the top measurement for chromium, that's reported as less than LOD. So whatever the XRF saw was below what it thought its detection limit was. But the other interesting thing here is then in the next column over, in the error column, it doesn't report the error in that case. It reports the detection limit. So in this particular case, it thinks its detection limit for chromium was around 170 ppm, and the chromium it saw was less than that. So it reported it as a less than LOD. Now, the interesting thing about detection limits and an XRF unit, and we'll talk some more about this in subsequent slides, but let's bring it up here as a starting point. If you go to SW846, method 6200, and look at the way detection limits are defined there, the detection limit for an XRF is defined as three times the error of a measurement when a measurement's taken of a sample and that element's not present in the sample. And actually, you see that definition at play here in these chromium results. If you look at the error associated with row 14, the error is around 60 ppm. If you look at the error in the row just above it, which was a non-detect, it's around 170 ppm, or about three times the error of the measurement below when there actually was a result that was obtained. So something to pay attention to when your XRF is reporting errors, that depending on whether it sees a detect or non-detect, the way you would interpret it, the error column changes from, for detection, an actual error estimate, to a non-detect, the detection limit. It's a subtle thing, but it's an important thing to be aware of. Any questions about this slide that I can answer?
Yes, I have a question. So on this one, whether it's Intevac or Niton, if it's below LOD, that will always be three times?
The detection limit will always, what gets reported as the error is actually then, at that case, the detection limit. And that is actually three times the error associated with the measurement.
But where there is a result on the Niton, it will be two times standard deviation.
That's exactly right. With the Niton, when you do get a result, the error that's reported is twice the standard deviation. With the Intevac, it's one times the standard deviation, so that they're different in the way they do that.
So if you're meshing together two sets of data from two different instruments, you have to keep that in mind.
You would have to be very careful about how that was done. Yeah, that's correct. Any other questions? All right, let's go on to 2-8. Oh, well, just one further comment about 2-7. We'll talk about this later, but let me just bring it up now again. When an XRF unit reports a non-detect, there is a measured result sitting behind that non-detect. It's just choosing not to report it. And I'm going to talk more about that later. Sometimes getting access to that measured result can be very important, even though it's below the detection limits associated with the measurement. So just keep in mind that even though it's only saying less than LOD, in fact, there is a measured value that's back there. It's just choosing not to tell you in this spreadsheet. And most instruments can be set up to force them to report those measured values, whether they're above the detection limit or below the detection limit. But the way a standard unit is set up is that typically it won't. You have to override the initial factory count settings in order to get it to do that. Okay, so let's go on to 2-8. So what elements can an XRF measure? Well, typically we're limited to elements that have an atomic number that's greater than 16. If you go to method 6200 and SW846, you'll see 26 elements listed as potentially measurable. And in fact, that list of 26 is not complete. There are more that it can measure that are not included in that list of 26, but they're just not as common. XRF is not effective for light metals. So if you're chasing beryllium, you would never do it with an XRF because you would not get usable data in that kind of context. So there are some situations, some elements, where an XRF just simply is not appropriate. The other item to note is that an XRF's performance is very much element-specific. And so while it may get relatively low detection limits, for example, for lead, you may find that for chromium, they're significantly higher. And so as you go from element to element, the performance that you observe is going to change. And in fact, there's something else that goes on with an XRF, and that is, in the case of some elements, you can have interference effects between the element you may have an interest in and other elements that are present in the sample. And a classic example of that is arsenic and lead. If lead is significantly elevated relative to the amount of arsenic that's there, it can start to interfere with the XRF's ability to correctly quantify the amount of arsenic that's present. And that's called an interference effect. We'll talk more about that a bit later, but that's just something to bear in mind, that you have to pay attention to what your contaminants of concern are, and then to what types of other things that might be present, other elements that might be present, that might potentially interfere with your ability to correctly quantify the contaminants that you really have an interest in. Any questions regarding that slide?
Hey, Bob, it's Steve. Quickly, we got a question coming in, typed in chat question, and I know you have a series of slides later on that talks about how an instrument determines detection limits.
Sure.
But this is a slightly different take on that, and it basically the question is, can you explain more about how the device estimates error? So in other words, when it gives you that standard deviation, how is it? Covered in later slides, or
No, it's not. So let me answer that question. It's an excellent question. The way that the XRF estimates error is strictly mathematically. It's statistically based. It's based on something called counting statistics. And I'm not going to go into the details about how that's done, but the important thing is with an XRF is you can check to see whether an XRF's error estimate is correct or not. It's a very easy thing to check. And the way you can check it is if you were to take a sample and do repeated measurements on that sample, you can look at the standard deviation associated with those repeated measurements and compare that standard deviation to the average reported error that's associated with those measurements. And what you'll find, we do this all the time, is that they'll be very, very close. In other words, when the XRF mathematically estimates how much error is present in a measurement, it turns out that it actually does a pretty good job. And then if you were actually to observe the error through repeated measurements, you'd find that they're approximately the same value. So it's something that's mathematically calculated, but it's something that you can physically check if you have any concerns about it at all, just to make sure that the XRF is doing what it's supposed to do. All right, so how about if we go on to slide 2-9? How is an XRF calibrated? There's a number of different ways of calibrating XRFs, and I'm not going to get into the detail because that goes beyond the scope of this presentation, but let me just say just a couple quick things about XRF calibration. An XRF will come pre-calibrated from the factory for a suite of elements. That factory calibration is applied to every single instrument that comes out of that particular manufacturer. And I think in the case of both Innovex and Niton, they pride themselves on the fact that if you have a detector, for example, Niton, that's been calibrated for lead in soils, and then you get another detector from that same company, same detector, you should get very, very similar performance, and the calibration should be exactly the same. The main point here, though, the two main points, is first of all, if there's any concern about a calibration at all that's been factory supplied, you can always check it. And as a matter of fact, Steve in later modules, when he talks about QC, will talk about checking calibrations to make sure that, in fact, you're getting good, unbiased results. And if you're not happy with the results, you can always recalibrate an XRF using physical samples and going through a calibration process. So that's called an empirical calibration. That's possible. The second important point is that XRFs that have been calibrated for environmental applications typically are calibrated with the idea that they're going to be looking for contaminant concentrations that are less than the percent range of concentrations, so less than 10,000 ppm. It's an important point because a linear calibration, and it doesn't matter whether you're talking about an XRF or any other lab technique, the calibration of an instrument holds over a specified range, and when you're outside that range, you should have no expectation that that calibration is going to be correct. Now, in the case of when you're working with an off-site laboratory, if you send a sample to the lab, and that sample concentration exceeds its calibration range, the lab has a very simple solution to the problem. They dilute the sample until they get something that falls within the range of their calibration range of their instrument. You can't do that with an XRF out in the field. So what you just have to be cognizant of, aware of, is that if you start to fall, if you start to have concentrations that are going to fall outside the dynamic range, what's called the dynamic range of that instrument, and typically it's more than 10,000 ppm, although it may, you might start to see these effects already at 3, 4, 5,000 ppm, then it's likely that the XRF is going to start under-reporting the actual concentration of what is there. And that's strictly a product of the fact that it's impossible to come up with a linear calibration that holds over the complete range of concentrations that you might typically run into. So an XRF that's been calibrated for environmental applications, been calibrated basically to give you a good estimate between its detection limit and around 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 ppm, up to maybe 5,000 ppm. Above that, it's going to give you values, but you start to be concerned about whether those values are accurate or not. Any questions about that?
Bob, we have two, one's a comment and another is a question referring back to the previous slide, slide 8. The newer units, the XLT3 series from Niton actually can detect magnesium, aluminum, and silicon. I'm not sure if they need the light element. Sometimes they have to run it through like a helium gas or something like that. I'm not sure exactly. I'd have to talk to the manufacturer. That was a comment that there's actually some additional elements that you can see, like magnesium, aluminum, silicon. And the other one was why is it not, and the second question was why are XRFs not effective for those lighter elements, or some of the elements that you list on the slide?
Yeah. So to address both the comment and the question, that in fact is the case that if you go to either Intevax or Niton and tell them that you're looking for something specific, they will do their best. In terms of those lighter elements, they will do their best to give you a system that will perform for those lighter elements. Now, there's still potentially performance issues with those instruments. In other words, you wouldn't expect to see detection limits that are comparable to what you might see for a heavier element like lead. But in fact, both manufacturers are pushing the technology here when it comes to lighter elements and providing some options for chasing those. Whether it's applicable or not to your situation, different story. But certainly there are some solutions that are coming up. But the second question, that is, why isn't it applicable to those lower energies? And it has to do with the way, with the physics of what's going on when you're using an XRF. And the fact that you're irradiating that sample, when you irradiate the sample with an X-ray out of the XRF, really what it's doing is it's knocking an electron out of an orbital into another orbital, and then when that electron tries to fall back into its original orbital, that's when it's releasing its characteristic X-ray. Well, with lighter elements, you've got your orbitals much closer to your nucleus, and so the ability of the XRF to do what it needs to do becomes much more limited. Now, that's a very simplistic answer to the question, but that's fundamentally what you're fighting against. As opposed to heavier elements, where you have orbitals that are higher up, and relatively easier to get what it is you need in terms of being able to detect the characteristic X-ray coming off. All right, so how about if we go on to figure 2-10? The point of figure 2-10 here is to underscore the final note on slide 2-9, and that is you have to watch out for dynamic range issues when you're working with data sets that span a wide range of concentrations. Here we're looking at a scatter plot that shows you ICP-lead results on the x-axis against XRF-lead results on the y-axis. Each of those points that you see in that scatter plot refers to a sample that was analyzed by both XRF and ICP. The bulk of the data are clustered down around 1,000 ppm or less, but we have two data points that are up around 6 and 8,000 ppm. If you look at the regression line that was put through this data, you'll see that the slope is only 0.54, which is not a good slope at all for a regression line in this kind of setting. And as a matter of fact, if you look at your data closely, it almost looks like it's not a straight line, like there's almost like a curve that you could be putting through it instead. And the point being that those two high values, around 6,000, 8,000 ppm, in that particular case, the XRF is probably underestimating how much lead is actually present in those samples, and we're probably pushing our dynamic range here. And so we're not getting a linear response over that entire range of concentrations that we're observing. Now, where does this become an issue? That's the last bullet in the slide. It's primarily an issue with risk assessments. If you want to use XRF data for risk assessments, typically when you do a risk assessment, you're taking a set of samples and you're calculating an average value from those, and from that average value you may then calculate an exposure point concentration or something like that. But the expectation is that that average is going to be accurate. But if you have XRF data that has some very high values, in fact those high values may be underestimating how much contaminant is there, which in fact may then have an impact on the accuracy of your average that's being calculated. So that's the kind of thing where you have to pay attention to this. If you're just interested in using an XRF for determining whether you're above or below, say, for example, 400 ppm for lead, this kind of thing doesn't matter, because who cares if it's 8,000 ppm or 16,000 ppm? The fact is you're way over 400 ppm and you're going to do something. So whether this dynamic range thing becomes an issue for you or not really depends on the application that you're looking at with your XRF. Any questions about this slide?
Does this chart show the same sample, meaning both the ICAP and the XRF used the same prepared sample? Do you know?
In this particular case, these samples were split. So I don't think it was true with this data set that somebody took the XRF cup and sent it off to the lab for ICP analysis. And we'll talk a bit more about that a little bit later when we talk about comparing XRF data with lab data and how best to do that. I think in this particular case, there was a subsample that was taken for XRF analysis, and then the rest of the sample was sent off to the lab for ICP analysis. But the short answer, though, is it should have been prepared. The sample underwent preparation before the XRF cup was taken out, so one would expect a good relationship between the XRF data and the ICP data.
Okay, thank you.
And you're welcome.
Bob, one more quick question that came in. Arsenic values are typically less than 100 ppm, so how is that affected by calibration?
Yeah, so...
touch on that.
From an interference perspective, there's a couple things there. From a calibration perspective, with arsenic, you typically wouldn't have concerns about getting values outside your dynamic range. The thing you should be concerned about with arsenic, though, is the effects that lead might be having if it turns out that there's lead co-located with arsenic and lead is elevated. The typical rule of thumb that's used is that if your lead concentration is more than 10 times your arsenic concentration, be suspicious about your arsenic results. So, for example, if your XRF was telling you had 20 ppm arsenic, but there was 500 ppm lead also present, I'd be suspicious of that 20 ppm arsenic value. That's the thing you have to watch out for with arsenic. Let's go on to 2-11. This is the standard factory calibration list for an Intevax unit, and the list for Nikon would be very similar to this, just some small differences. But this gives you a sense for what an instrument would come calibrated for if you got it directly from the factory. All right, let's go on to slide 2-12.
Bob, on that, there was a question on the last one, just why is thallium's not listed in that list? I know that's the standard list, but there was a question as to whether or not XRF is feasible for thallium.
That's a good question, and I haven't had a lot of experience with thallium. I know that the latest instruments from Niton, and I believe from Innovex as well, can include thallium in the list that they're calibrated for. How good it would be for thallium, I haven't had any experience, so I wouldn't be able to address that.
My experience as well. I don't think we've had too many thallium sites where we've tried to use XRF.
Yeah, I know in the last round of XRF applications that set of fieldwork that I was involved with, thallium was being reported, but how good the data was, I'm not sure, because it wasn't, in that particular case, it wasn't a contaminant concern. All right, 2-12. Let's talk about XRF performance and the ways we commonly define it. XRF performance is no different than any other analytical technique, on-site or off-site, in a standard laboratory. We're concerned about bias, we're concerned about precision, we're concerned about detection limits, we're concerned about quantitation limits, representativeness, and comparability. I have some detailed slides coming up here about precision, detection limits, quantitation limits, and comparability. Representativeness is a huge issue that Dean is going to talk about much more extensively in subsequent modules, so I'm not going to really touch on representativeness today. Unfortunately, I don't have a slide for bias, so I'm going to just spend a few moments talking about bias and what it is and what one might potentially be concerned about with an XRF. When we talk about bias with an XRF, we're talking about the possibility that an XRF is systematically underreporting or overreporting the concentration for a particular element that's of interest on average. And when I say on average, what I mean is you might look at any individual result and compare that with its lab split value from ICP, and you might find that sometimes it's over and sometimes it's under. But on average, you might find that it's under, or on average, you might find that it's over. Okay, that would be an indication that bias is present. Bias can take two different forms with an XRF. There can be a systematic bias that's absolute. In other words, XRF always seems to be about 20 or 30 ppm high. There can also be a component of bias that's relative. In other words, the XRF always seems to be reporting about 120% of what the lab is reporting, or it's only reporting about 70% of what the lab is reporting. Or you could have a combination of the two. You could have both things going on. Now, the reason that bias might be present, you might have bias present not because of the XRF, but because of your off-site laboratory. And typically that happens if there's extraction issues with the element that you have an interest in. And the one that gets frequently cited, and if you look at SW846 Method 6200, you'll see it there, is antimony. And what's happening then is that you have an element where standard extraction practices don't get all the element out of the sample before it's submitted for the actual analysis. And consequently, so your ICP result may be systematically underestimating the total amount of metal present in the sample. When an XRF does a measurement on a sample, if it's been calibrated correctly, it is measuring the total amount of metal that's in that sample, not just the extractable amount. ICP, on the other hand, is just measuring the extractable amount. So you could have a bias present when you compare your XRF data and your lab data that has, again, nothing to do with the XRF. It's indicative of a potential extraction issue with your laboratory. But the flip side is also true. You can have what appears to be a bias present in your XRF data, and that has something to do with the way the XRF is behaving. It may be a calibration issue, or there may be something else going on. But that's potentially something to be aware of and something to be concerned of. A recent example that I had of that was a piece of work that we just finished in May at a site where barium was present. Of course, barium is always present. Barium was not identified as a contaminant of concern. We came out with three different XRF units, and those three different XRF units gave systematically different results for barium. And in all three cases, those results were different than the lab. Now, unfortunately for the site, although barium had not been identified as a contaminant of concern, when the XRF results started coming back and they were an order of magnitude higher than background as measured by historical lab samples, it flagged barium as a potential issue that we then had to sort through to determine what was going on. What we ended up concluding was that there seemed to be a bias there present for barium with those instruments that we had fielded. So that's an example of where bias can potentially become an issue with an XRF. So that's all I really have to say about bias, but I'm going to talk about precision, detection limits, quantitation limits, and comparability in the next series of slides. So let's go on to 2-13. Now let's first of all talk about precision of an XRF measurement. Now, what do I mean by precision? By precision, I mean if you were to take an XRF measurement repeatedly of a particular sample, the precision of that sample would be a measure of how close the results were together or how much spread there was in those results. And obviously, the closer they are, the better the precision is and the happier we are probably with the data. Now, what kinds of things affect an XRF's precision for any particular element? Well, one of those, is measurement time. If you increase the measurement time associated with your XRF measurement, you are going to improve your precision. You're going to reduce the error associated with that measurement. And the rule of thumb is that quadrupling the measurement time cuts your measurement error in half. So that's the general rule. So if you went from a 30-second acquisition time to a 120-second acquisition time, you should see your error associated with your measurement get cut in half. The second thing that influences analytical precision is the concentration that's present. As your contaminant concentrations increase, the absolute error associated with that measurement increases as well. And that's not just true for an XRF. That's pretty much true for almost any analytical technique that you would attempt to use. That error, analytical error, is a function of your element concentration. The third thing that comes into play, though, with an XRF, though, is the concentrations of other elements. And that is, as other elements in that sample, as their concentrations increase, it'll have an impact on the precision associated with the particular element that you have an interest in. So, for example, and I'll show you a slide of this in a little bit, if you had an interest in chromium, but there happened to be in a particular sample a ton of lead present, in that particular sample, you'd see an adverse impact on the precision of your chromium measurement as well. And that doesn't have anything necessarily to do with interference. It just has to do with basically background noise that increased values of lead have on that chromium measurement. So that's not something else that can be a factor. Any questions about that slide? So, slide 214.
For the element concentration presence, that as you're saying that when the concentration is greater, the error will increase. Is that the case for every analytical method? I thought that when we have when we have small amounts of an element, some sort of in analysis, lower concentrations will always give us more error, more difficulty, whereas the accuracy of that, the precision of that particular concentration or measurement. Is that just for XRF or is it general? And I may be incorrect, actually.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the complete comment. Could you, or question?
When the concentration of the element is smaller, my understanding has been that it may create more difficulties with an error as far as increasing the error. I'm not sure. Is this for XRF analysis or generally for any method?
Yeah, that's an excellent comment.
I'm a corrective action project manager. I'm just going by my general knowledge on the issue.
Sure. Why don't you hold that question just for a moment? Let me show you the next two slides, and I think maybe it'll get at what you're bringing up. Because really, there's two different issues here that we're talking about. There's the absolute error, and then there's the relative error. And usually what people look at is relative error for lab measurements, not absolute error. So if you look here at slide 2-14, you'll see that in this particular case, we have lead concentrations down along the x-axis, and the error reported by the instrument up along the y-axis. For this data set, you can clearly see the relationship between the lead concentration and the reported error. And it's a very nice relationship. As that concentration increases, the absolute error associated with each measurement increases as well. If we go to the next slide, which is 2-15, this is exactly the same data set. but we're looking at error from a different perspective. In this particular case, we're looking at the percent error. In other words, the absolute error divided by the concentration. And we see exactly the opposite effect. In other words, as concentrations go up, while absolute error may be increasing, the percent error actually is decreasing. Okay? So I think this maybe gets back to the question or the comment that was raised, and that is, as concentrations get small, our relative error, our percent error, gets large. And that interferes at that point with our ability to draw good conclusions about exactly what the concentration is that's present. So, in the particular case of XRF, there are a couple of points that I want to make from this slide that are important. First of all, this relationship between concentration and error is a very nice one, as you can see from this graph. It's very predictable. The second point is that because of the way detection limits are defined with an XRF, you can never have an error, a percent error, with an XRF measurement that's more than 33%. Because once your measurement error is more than 33%, your XRF is going to report it as a non-detect. Okay, so the worst an XRF can be for measurements above detection limits is having a relative error that's 33%. In this particular case with lead, you know, the typical action level for lead is around 400 ppm. So if you look closely at this graph, when we're at 400 ppm, we have an analytical error that's only around 5%, which is actually very, very good. The point being is that the XRF is a relatively very precise instrument. And of course, that depends on which element you're looking at. But in the case of lead here, by the time we get to the typical action level, we have analytical errors that are only 5%, which is what you typically would expect. It is as good or better than what you typically expect from an analytical laboratory doing these types of analyses. And then as you get above 400 ppm, you can see that your relative error is actually falling, steadily falling. Any questions about this slide? So let's go to the next one, 2-16. So how does an XRF calculate detection limits? Well, when you get an XRF unit, whether it's from Niton or Intervax or from somebody else, they follow the definition of detection limits as provided in SW846, method 6200. And in that method, it defines detection limits as 3 times the standard deviation that's attributable to analytical variability at a low concentration. So what happens practically, though, is when an XRF does its measurement, if it sees a sample where there's very little of the particular element of interest, it measures the X-rays that are coming off, it calculates the error associated with the measurement that it's making, it compares the result it has with 3 times that error, and if that result is less than 3 times the error, it reports it as a non-detect, as something less than the detection limit. Okay? You could also potentially calculate detection limits by measuring a sample with little or no of the element of interest in it and looking at the error associated with those measurements and then doing your own calculation that way. But so the detection limit that's calculated by an XRF is measurement specific and it's based on Kalman statistics. Now, a common mistake that I've seen people make, and it's something you need to be aware of, is people will sometimes try to calculate detection limits for measurements where the XRF is actually reported value. For example, let's say you were chasing lead in soils, and the XRF came back and said there was 600 ppm in a particular sample. And then the question was asked, well, what was the detection limit for that measurement? And somebody might say, well, look at 600 ppm, let's look at the error associated with that measurement, and then let's multiply that error by 3, and by golly, I'm coming up with 100 ppm. That must have been the detection limit for that measurement. And that would be incorrect. Now, why is that incorrect? It's incorrect, again, going back to the previous 2 slides. It's incorrect because error is a function, an increasing function, of the concentration present. And so when you have a lot of an element present, if the error associated with that measurement has increased significantly, if you were to try to estimate a detection limit based on that error, you would be not consistent anymore with the way detection limits are defined. So that's something to be careful about. Any questions about this slide? So let's go on to 217, and I'm going to try to illustrate this concept of both of detection limits and quantitation limits via a couple different slides here. In 2-17, What you're looking at is basically a histogram or a frequency chart of that shows the results from repeated measurements of a sample that doesn't have an element present. In other words, this sample has, let's say we have an interest in lead. This sample has no lead in it at all. But we've done repeated measurements for the XRF, and in fact the XRF reports lead values. If there's no lead at all, half the time those lead values that it reports are going to be negative, and half the time those values will be positive. And if you do a histogram, you might get a nice curve that looks like this. This particular curve has a standard deviation of 5 ppm. So applying the XRF definition of detection limits to this curve would say that the detection limit is 15 ppm, or 3 times 5. What that means practically is that if the XRF were to report a value that was above 15 ppm, there's a there's only a very small probability or possibility that in fact that sample didn't have any lead in it at all. So are you with me here? The purpose of the detection limit definition is to identify a level above which if the XRF says it's there, then in fact there really is something there. Okay? Let's go to the next slide, 2-18. What's important? Yeah, sure.
Just to let folks know, we realize there's about 4 or 5 questions in the queue right now, but I'm looking at the clock, and I just want to make sure Bob's got it on the order of 40 slides, so I want to make sure we have enough time to get through all the slides. So if we hold off on answering the questions for a few minutes, we will try to answer them at the end of the session or somewhere along the way, or worst-case scenario, we push it to the beginning of Thursday's session, where we'll answer in more detail the questions that we weren't able to get to today. Just to let folks know, we see them piling up, but just want to give Bob enough time, so thanks.
Okay. So slide 218. Important point here for everybody to take away from this, and that is the detection limit associated with XRF measurement is not the same as a reliable detection or quantitation limit. Okay, and I'm going to try to illustrate that point with these couple of slides. So using the same basis as the previous slide, here we're looking at a graph that's a little bit different. Along our x-axis, we have the actual concentration. Along the y-axis, we have the probability that we would report a detectable amount. So let's just assume we have an instrument that has a detection limit of 15 ppm. If the actual concentration present in a sample was 10 ppm, and you were to do repeated measurements on that sample, you might generate the curve here that's in orange, that you're looking at, that's orange. The part under that curve that's shaded red is the fraction of those measurements that would have generated a detect by the instrument, where the instrument would have said, aha, there's something more than 15 ppm here. I'm going to call this a detection, and I'm going to report something. Okay, so that fraction is something less than 50%, maybe in this particular case, maybe it's 30% of the time, the XRF would be flagging a detection. If you go to the next slide, 2-19, let's just suppose our actual concentration was right at 50 ppm in a sample, the detection limit of the instrument. What that means is if I measured that sample multiple times with the XRF, half the time it would report it as a detection, and half the time it would report it as a non-detect. So in other words, if I had a sample that surely had 15 ppm, it would only catch it 50% of the time, that in fact there was something detectable in that sample. If you go to the next slide, here the actual concentration now is 20 ppm. And as you can see, once the sample has 20 ppm in it, it's much more likely that the XRF would be reporting something that's detectable. And by the time you get, well, I guess I had another slide, but I don't. But if by the time if you had an actual concentration that got out to 30 ppm, then the XRF would almost always report something as being detectable above 15 ppm. In general, if you want to be absolutely sure that the XRF is catching something, you have to, if the question is not what's the detection limit, but what's the concentration that I can be absolutely sure the XRF is always going to catch, it's twice the detection limit. So if your detection limit is 15, you have to have 30 ppm present in that sample before the XRF is always going to catch it. It won't necessarily say it's 30 ppm, Sometimes it'll say it's more, sometimes it'll say it's less, but at least they're always recorded as a detection. All right. Any questions about that? 2-21. So, what influences detection limits? Well, for any particular instrument and element combination, there's a number of factors. The first one, again, is measurement time. The longer you acquire your measurement, the lower your detection limits will be. And again, if you quadruple your measurement time, you'll, in practice, cut your detection limits by about in half. So if you're not happy with the detection limits you're getting off an instrument, one solution is simply to increase the measurement time that's being used for measuring the sample. And the second thing has to do with matrix effects, and this will vary from sample to sample, depending on the matrix that's present and its characteristics, you may see your detection limits rise or fall. The third is the presence of other things that might be other elements that might be interfering with the element that you have an interest in. And the more that those other elements are present, the more of an impact they're going to have on your detection limit for the element that you do have an interest in. And as a matter of fact, that detection limit will rise. Consequently, the detection limit for any particular element is going to change from sample to sample, from measurement to measurement. And it's going to depend on your sample characteristics and on your operator choices, e.g. the measurement time that they're using. Next slide. 2-22. And here's a slide that illustrates that. These are all data that have been generated with an Intevax unit. In each particular case, 120-second acquisition. The first column was for a soil standard. The second column is for a sample from an alluvial deposit. The third column is from a sample that was collected beneath a leaking waistline. The numbers that are inside this table, the ones that are in normal font, are the detection limits that the instrument was reporting. The numbers that are in bold font are actual measured values. So the detection limit is something significantly less than that measured value. Now, the thing I want you to look at here, in particular, is mercury. And the mercury is down toward the bottom, third one from the bottom, third row from the bottom. In our soil standard, the detection limit was 10 ppm. The detection limit reported for our alluvial sample was 8 ppm. And in fact, the mercury that was present in that alluvial sample was something less than 8 ppm. So the instrument reported the detection limit as 8 ppm. In the case of our sample that was pulled from beneath the waistline, our mercury detection limit has jumped up to 480 ppm. Why? It's because that sample had a lot of other elements in it, or metals in it, at fairly high concentrations, and that in turn affected the instrument's ability to accurately quantify mercury, and that was reflected by a rising detection limit. So the presence and amount of other elements present in the sample that you're measuring will have an impact across the board on your detection limits for all the other elements that you might potentially have an interest in. Right, next slide, 2-23. To report or not to report, that's the question. This gets back to something that was mentioned earlier, and that is that when you get an instrument from the factory and you use it, it's been set up so as not to report things that are below the detection limit, and instead to simply report less than LOD. Now, in the case of both Intevax and Niton, you can get into the instrument setup and force it to report those values, and sometimes there's a very good reason for doing that. And the reason that you might want to do that is because if your instrument has been properly calibrated and is not biased, that data, although it may be noisy data down at the low end, is useful data for calculating averages. So, for example, if you had an interest in knowing what the average concentration was across an exposure unit, and 80% of your samples are coming back with XRF data that were less than limits of detection, one option would be to take that data and massage it the way people typically have massaged it. In other words, saying, well, all those non-detects, well, we'll use the detection limit as a substitute, or we'll use half the detection limit as a substitute, or we'll do something more sophisticated, use Pro-UCL to do that. Or you could work with the raw data and calculate your average based on the raw data, no matter whether it was above the detection limit or below the detection limit. And the case that I would make is that, in fact, doing the latter will give you a more accurate estimate of what your concentration is on average in that exposure unit than doing the former. In other words, treating things like non-detects and then doing something with those non-detects to try to allow you to calculate an average. So it could be that data that's been identified as below detection limits can be very, very useful data if you're careful about its use. But if you're careful about its use, you may find that it provides a lot of value in terms of the decisions you might have to make. Okay, next slide. I have a series of slides now that are going to talk about XRF data comparability. As Steve mentioned early on, despite the fact that the XRF has been around a long time and the fact that there's been a lot of experience with it, typically, because it's a field XRF is thought of as a field instrument, there's still a certain amount of uncertainty or maybe skepticism about how good the data is. And so frequently there's a requirement that you compare data you get from an XRF with the data that you're getting from a lab, and the point of the comparison is to verify that, in fact, what you're getting from the XRF is usable or it doesn't have significant data quality problems associated with it. So let's talk here a little bit about XRF data comparability and what exactly that means and the kinds of things that you have to watch out for if you're doing that. So again, comparability here usually refers to comparing an XRF result with a standard lab result. And typically what's done is sample is measured by XRF and then split, and the split sent off to the laboratory for some kind of corresponding ICP analysis. So the assumption is we have samples that have been analyzed by both an XRF and the laboratory. The most commonly used ruler for measuring comparability is a regression analysis. And I got a couple of slides here about regression analysis because it's an important thing to cover in the context of an XRF. If you go to method SW846, method 6200, and look at what it has to say about regression analyses and data comparability, it makes a statement that if the R-squared, and the R-squared is a measure of how good the regression is, if the R-squared is 0.9 or greater, then XRF data could potentially meet the definitive level for data criteria. And we're going to talk some more about that in a few minutes. So let's go to the next slide. Regression analysis. What exactly is that? Here we have a graphic that shows a scatter plot. And in this scatter plot, there are four different points. And each of those points corresponds to a sample that's been analyzed both by the lab and by a real-time technique, in this particular case, an XRF. And so you see the table of results in the lower right-hand corner of the graph. And then the results graphed in this scatter plot, with our x-axis being our traditional lab results and our y-axis being, in this particular case, our XRF results. Now the question would be, okay, how good is this relationship between the lab and what we're getting off our XRF? Well, one way to measure that is with a regression line. And a regression line is simply a line, a straight line, that is in some fashion or notion best fit to these points. Now, what does best fit mean for a regression line? Well, if you look at the distance between each point and the line, the vertical distance, that vertical distance is called a residual. And in fact, what a regression tries to do is it tries to find the line that minimizes the sum of those squared residuals. Okay, that's what a regression is doing. And when it finds a line that comes up with a minimum value for those squared residuals, it says, well, hey, this is the best line. And then it'll give you an equation for that line. And you'll see an equation up here at the top of this graphic. Y is equal to 0.95x plus 0.38. And it gives you what's called an R squared. In this particular case, the R squared is reported at 0.89. And that R squared is a measure of how good the line did in matching those points. Now let's just talk about that line definition there in the R squared a little bit. That 0.95 refers to the slope of the line. If you had a perfect calibration between your XRF instrument and your lab, you would expect the slope to be 1. In other words, if you added another 1 ppm to your lab sample, you should see another 1 ppm added to your XRF result, right? The second part of that line, that 0.38, refers to where that line crosses the y-intercept, the y-axis. It's known as the y-intercept. And it's a measure or an indication of a bias that might be present in the regression line. The R-squared is a number that can run between 0 and 1. If your R-squared is 0, that means there's no relationship at all between your XRF data and your lab data. It's just a shotgun scatter, random. If the R-squared were 1, all these points would fall exactly on that line. In other words, the line would fit the points exactly. Typical R-squared runs then between 0 and 1. The closer to 1 it is to 1, the better the regression line. Let's go on to the next slide, 2-26. So here are these terms again, now written out in verbiage. Again, a scatter plot, you're simply showing paired sample results. Your x-axis is typically your lab. Your y-axis is typically your XRF. Your residuals are measuring the difference between sample points in your scatter plot and your regression line. Your adjusted R-squared, that measures how good your regression line is doing. And then the last two terms, homoscedasticity and heteroscedasticity. What the heck is that? That refers to whether those residuals are uniformly distributed around that line or whether the degree to which they're off the line changes as your concentrations change. And I've got a slide here that illustrates that. And that's the next slide. So if you go to 2-27, this is actually not XRF data. It's LIBS data, laser-induced breakdown spectroscopy versus beryllium results. But it illustrates this heteroscedasticity, homoscedasticity concept very nicely. So here I have a scatter plot of LIBS data for beryllium versus lab data for beryllium. And what you see is that the scatter of these points around that regression line increases as the concentration increases. That's heteroscedasticity. And in fact, environmental data always display this kind of behavior, that if you were to do a scatter plot and then look at the way those points are scattered around a regression line, typically you'll see that scatter increase as your concentrations increase. Now, why is that important? It's important because when you're doing a regression line, one of the things people like to do is they like to put error bars around their regression lines. And there's software that allows you to do that automatically. You just feed it your data, and it gives you the regression line, and by golly, it puts those nice error bars around your regression line. Well, when you have heteroscedastic data, which almost all environmental data is, you have to be very, very suspicious of those error bars, because those error bars assume that your data is homoscedastic, and environmental data rarely is that. Fine point, but I just wanted to bring it to your attention, because oftentimes you'll see regression lines presented that way. All right, let's go on to the next slide. 2-28. What's an appropriate regression analysis? If you have XRF data and lab data, what would be an appropriate regression analysis to do? Well, these are the things that you would look for. Ideally, your results, your analytical results, would be from the same subsample that was used for your XRF. In other words, in a perfect world, you would take a subsample, measure it in a cup with an XRF, and then take that cup's contents and send that off for ICP analysis. That gives you the best comparability data. All right, number one. Number two, the samples you're sending off for lab analyses, for paired lab analyses, should focus on those concentration ranges that are really pertinent to your decision making. In other words, they shouldn't all be clustered down at the low end, nor should they be an order of magnitude to orders of magnitude higher than your decision level. All right, in either case, it's going to mess with your regression line. The third thing is that if you have non-detects, you ought to remove them from your data set. Now, this third one's an interesting one, because typically, where do you see non-detects in metals data? Well, you don't see it from the lab, because for most metals, you'll get detectable results back from your laboratory. Where you see non-detects is in your XRF data. And this gets back to the earlier point that I had made, and that is, if you can set up your XRF to report its values, measured values, whether they're above or below your detection limits, that's a good thing for doing regression analyses, because I can eliminate non-detects then from the analysis. In other words, I can use the actual data that the XRF is reporting, even if it's below its detection limits, and in fact, that will improve the regression analysis that I would be doing. And then the last point, your best regression results are obtained when your data pairs, are balanced at opposite ends of the range of interest. What does this all mean? Well, let's go over to 2-29 and just expand upon this a little bit. So what's a good regression line? Well, there's no evidence of inexplicable outliers or data points that fall way off the line that we can't explain. Our data sets are balanced across the range of concentrations that we have an interest in. There's no signs of correlated residuals, and I'm going to show you an example of that here in just a moment. We have high R-squared values that are close to 1. and our data is homoscedastic. Now, in the case of the last one, we know that probably won't be the case, but we'd like it to be. Now, one of the reasons I'm putting this slide up is, again, if you go to Method 6200 and look in there at their definition of a good regression, the only thing that they highlight is a high R squared, and that's a dangerous thing. And I'm going to show you an example of why that's a dangerous thing in just a moment. So let's go to the next slide, 2-30. Here's an actual data set. And you've seen some of this data before in an earlier scatter plot. I'm going to show it to you again. This is an XRF applied to lead. And I actually have two different scatter plots. The one at the top shows all the data. The one at the bottom shows the data with the high values trimmed off. And in both cases, I fitted a regression line. If you look at the top regression line, it has a wonderful R-squared that is almost 1. It's 0.95. You can't get much better than that. But other than that high R-squared, it really is an awful regression. It's an awful regression for a number of reasons. First of all, almost all the data are on the low end, and you only have 2 data points on the high end. And it's those 2 data points that drive that regression line. Secondly, if you look at the slope of that line, 0.54, it's not even close to 1, which should be a flag right away that there's a potential problem here with this regression, as well as a large y-intercept of 200 ppm. The third thing is if you look at the way your points are scattered around that line, down at the low end, very low end, they're all below the line, and then they all are above the line, that's evidence of what's called a correlated residual. In other words, the residuals are all behaving the same way when you're in a particular concentration range. Okay? That is an awful, ugly regression line, even though it has a very high R squared. As soon as we take those 2 high points out, though, you get the bottom graphic. And now look what happens to our regression. Suddenly we get a slope that's almost exactly 1. We get a y-intercept that is much closer to 0 than we had previously. Our data is evenly distributed around, across that line in terms of our concentrations going from 0 to 400 ppm. The residuals are not correlated. In other words, if you look at any particular range of data, some of them, the points fall above the line, some of them fall below the line, but they're not consistently above or below. But look at the R squared. The R squared dropped from 0.95 to 0.85. So if you were just focusing on R squared, you'd say that the first regression line was much better. But in actual fact, it's the second line that's the accurate regression line that really should be the point of comparison, not the first one. Point here being that you could take data from a study, a comparability study, and draw completely different conclusions about whether your XRF was giving you good information or bad information, just depending on how the regression was done. The second reason I really want to hammer this is a lot of times what you see people do with XRF data is they'll do a regression on the XRF data, and then they'll say, oh, look, the regression line says that the data sets are really different. I'm going to transform my XRF data so that it's equivalent to my lab data by putting it through my regression line so I can back calculate what an equivalent lab value might have been. All right? But if you were to do that in this particular case with the top regression line, you would, in fact, be not improving your XRF data. You would be making it much worse. Okay? So by having, you know, if you don't end up with the right regression line here, you can depending on how you use that regression line, you can draw up the wrong conclusions about how comparable your data are, and also you might do damage to your data set if you start using that line to transform XRF data. So if there's nothing else you take away from this series this afternoon, this series of slides, it's this. Beware of comparability studies that use regression lines. Pay close attention to what was done and how it was done, because depending on what was done, they may be very misleading. All right, next slide, 2-31. Converting XRF data for risk assessment use. This refers to what I was just talking about. A lot of times people would like to use XRF data for risk assessment purposes. And in doing that, they want to pool their XRF data with their lab data and use the pooled data set for estimating, for example, an average value over an exposure unit. And if they do their regression analysis and they're not happy with their with a regression line, or if the regression line indicates that there's a big difference between their XRF data and their lab data, they might use that regression line for converting their XRF data to something that's lab equivalent. The purpose of this slide is to raise a red flag, to say, hey, wait, before you do that, think about a couple things. First of all, think about the fact that if your regression line indicates there's a need for conversion, that might be as much an indication of a bad regression as it is that there's something wrong with the XRF data. Second point being, and we touched on this very early in the presentation, you would not expect your XRF calibration to hold completely over the full range of concentrations that you might have encountered. So be aware of high-valued XRF readings. They may not be directly comparable to your lab results. And then, I'm going to skip over to the last bullet there. If you're trying to estimate the average concentration, say, over an exposure unit, and you're looking at either using a lot of XRF data that may be a bit more noisy than your lab data, but there's a lot more of it, versus using just a couple of lab data points, which from an analytical precision perspective may be better than your XRF data, but you only have a couple of them, you may find that your XRF data, in fact, does a much better job of estimating your mean and consequently your EPC, your exposure point concentration, than what your lab data is. And to illustrate that, let's go to the next slide, 2-32. Here's a real data set. These are lab results from an exposure unit. They just had four samples. This is for lead, and the four sample results were 20, 24, 86, and 189 ppm. The action level here was, as one typically finds, was 400 ppm. If you take these four data results and put them into ProUCL, ProUCL is a piece of software that the EPA puts out that allows one to easily calculate 95% UCLs on the average, and 95% UCL is typically what's used for estimating an exposure point concentration. So if you use ProUCL on these four data points, depending on what you assume your underlying distribution is, normally distributed or your data's gamma distributed or log normal, you get a completely different 95% UCL result that could range anywhere from 172 ppm all the way up to almost 34,000 ppm. Point here being that even though the quality of these lab results may be very, very good, four samples are simply not enough to determine, first of all, the level of variability that's present, or what the underlying contamination distribution is, or ultimately what your appropriate 95% UCL should be. And you come out with potentially a bad decision. Okay. Let's go to the next slide, 2-33. So the question comes up. Oh, well, the statement's often made. Lab data, it's definitive. XRF data, it's screening quality. Well, what's meant by that? Well, I guess typically what's meant by that is you can believe your lab, but be suspicious of your XRF. So I got a couple slides here that are hopefully make you a little bit skeptical of that assertion. Here you're looking at arsenic data. And these arsenic data were generated by collecting a set of samples, analyzing them by XRF, and splitting the samples and sending them to two different ICP labs. All right. In the case of one of these scatter plots, you're looking at XRF versus one of the ICP labs. In the case of the other scatter plot, you're looking at the ICP results from one lab plotted against the ICP results from the other lab. And my question for you is, which is which? Which of these two contains the XRF data, and which of these two contains strictly ICP data? And what I would maintain is that if you were just to look at these visually, you can't see any difference in performance. One lab versus the other lab versus XRF versus one of the labs. In fact, your XRF versus ICP data is the graph on the right. If you look at the regression line for that data set, that regression line is actually better than the regression line for the graph on the left, which is comparing ICP versus ICP. We have a better R-squared. We have a slope that's almost exactly 1 in the case of the XRF versus the ICP. So in actual fact, for this particular data set, it seems like our XRF is agreeing better with one of our ICP labs than the two ICP labs are agreeing with each other. The underlying point here is that when you see scatter in a scatter plot, when your XRF data and your lab data don't appear to agree 100%, it's not surprising. And it's not just because of the XRF. It's because there's noise in your lab data. All right? And so when you compare ICP versus ICP, you're going to see scatter in those data sets because they won't necessarily exactly agree. So just because there's scatter in your XRF data when you do a scatter plot comparing it to your ICP data, don't necessarily assume it's your XRF that's the problem. You may have a lab problem. And to illustrate that point, let's go to the next slide. Similar kind of scenario here. A slightly different setting. I'm not talking about arsenic. Here I'm talking about uranium. And as a matter of fact, XRF turns out to be very, very good for uranium. It's not a standard calibration. You have to ask for a special calibration from the factory, but a well-calibrated XRF that's been calibrated for uranium will do very, very well. Here I have a set of samples that were analyzed for uranium by both XRF and by alpha spectroscopy and by gamma spectroscopy. Both gamma spec and alpha spec are common, well-established, accepted methods for determining uranium content in soil samples. All right. In this particular case, on our left-hand side, we see the comparison between XRF and gamma spec for these sets of samples. On the right-hand side, we see alpha spec versus gamma spec. And what you ought to see here is that our XRF on the left agrees very well with our gamma spec, with the exception of one point. On our right, we see a lot of disagreement between our alpha spec and our gamma spec. So the same lab ran both the alpha spec and the gamma spec. So in fact, again, our XRF is doing a better job of producing data that's quote-unquote comparable to gamma spec than what our alpha spec is, even though our alpha spec would be considered, in some sense, a definitive method for uranium. Now, the two points that drive the alpha spec-gamma spec comparison bananas are at the high end. In one case, the alpha spec was way high. In the other case, the alpha spec was way low. Alpha spec is a technique that requires a fair amount of sample prep. And the suspicion here, in this particular case, is that what we have is a lab problem with the way those two samples were prepared, which consequently resulted in significant disagreement between gamma spec and alpha spec. Again, point being, your XRF, if you're careful with the way it's being deployed and used, there's no reason why it can't provide data that has a quality comparable to what you'd expect to get from an off-site laboratory. It all boils down to how good your QC program is and how effectively you deploy your XRF. And Steve will spend a lot of time in subsequent modules talking about QC and what's appropriate or an appropriate QC program for a field-deployed XRF. But again, just to underscore the fact, if that QC is in place, if you know what you're doing, you can get really, really good data off your XRF. So, next slide, 2-35. Takeaway comparability points. Standard laboratory data can be just as noisy as what your XRF data is, and it shouldn't be considered an error-free definitive representation of what reality is. Number one point. Number two point. When you do a regression, your R-squared alone is a poor measure of comparability. It is one measure of comparability, but in and of itself, it's a poor measure of comparability. The third, really, your focus should be on ultimately decision comparability. Is your XRF allowing you to make the right decisions rather than, first of all, on lab result comparability? And we're going to talk more about that in subsequent modules, not today. Then finally, if you examine lab duplicate paired results from, say, that would be generated from a traditional QC analysis, you probably would expect to see about the same amount of variability as what you'd see when you compare your XRF results to lab splits. In other words, no better, perhaps, and perhaps no worse. So, 2-36, next slide. What affects XRF performance overall? Just to kind of recap, measurement time. The longer you take your measurement, the better that measurement's going to be. Contaminant concentrations. As contaminant concentrations increase, your absolute error increases. However, your relative error decreases. But elevated contaminant concentrations can also, on the downside, enhance interference effects, so you have to watch out for that. The third point, sample preparation. the better the sample preparation, the more likely your XRF result is going to be representative of that original sample. And again, I'm going way back to the beginning. When you pull a sample, typically what you end up with is several hundred grams of dirt, if you're concerned with soils. If you do an XRF cup analysis, you're taking out maybe 5 grams. You're subsampling your original sample. If your original sample is not thoroughly homogenized and prepared, there's no reason to expect that that XRF cup result is representative of that original sample. That fact is not exclusive to the XRF. That fact is also true for ICP, because ICP, when you do an ICP analysis, requires a subsample that is very, very small. In both cases, if that sample hasn't been thoroughly prepared, don't expect the result to be representative of the sample. So what applies to an XRF applies to an ICP, and vice versa. On the flip side of that is, if you're doing a good job of sample prep, you should expect to see good data coming off your XRF. Next slide, 2-37. Other things that affect XRF performance, we've talked about some of these already, interference effects and what happens when you have spectral lines that overlap. Matrix effects can come into play. Fine versus coarse grain materials can have an impact on your calibration and your XRF performance. The last one is a critical one, and that is operator skills. An XRF looks simple to use, and in fact, a handheld XRF is. But the way it's used, and the experience of the person using it, is a critical factor in the quality of the data that you get. The fact is if that detector face is not squarely and uniformly placed against the surface it's measuring, you will not get repeatable results. And so an XRF operator who's sloppy about what they're doing will produce sloppy results. You will not get good data. So, you know, although you may be tempted to go out and rent an XRF and just go off and run with it, or give it to somebody else and say, go use it, because it's a point and shoot, gives you the data. Beware. If you're only going to get out of it what you basically put into it from an operator skill and experience perspective. All right, slide 2-38. What are common XRF applications? In situ and ex situ analysis of soil samples. You can do ex situ analyses of sediment samples. Swipe analyses for looking at removable contamination. You can do filter analyses in the context of air samples. Lead and paint applications are very, very common. So there are lots of different settings where an XRF could potentially be used, a field deployable XRF. Then the last two slides, slide 2-39. What's happened over the last couple of years? Well, there's been a number of things that have been happening with an XRF. First of all, electronics have gotten smaller. Secondly, detectors have gotten much better. Third, the batteries have gotten much better. Fourth, we've switched from sealed sources to X-ray tubes for X-ray generation, and those X-ray tubes have gotten much better. The algorithms within an XRF unit that translate spectrum to concentrations have gotten better. All those things taken together, I'll give you here slide 2-40, you see constantly improving performance. And across the top, what we have here is the first column is detection limits as reported by method 6200, and that method, you know, was last updated, at least from a detection limit perspective, in the late 90s. An older handheld unit, Niton unit, a TN900, again from the late 90s vintage, versus the latest Innovax. And I'm not picking on Innovax here because they're better than Niton. In fact, we recently did a detection limit study with both instruments and saw very comparable performance for both of their high-end handheld instruments. But look at, for example, what's happened to detection limits for chromium. Basically, that dropped from 200 ppm for the TN900 to 90 ppm for an Innovax unit. Where's another one that's good? Oh, arsenic is an excellent example. Going from 60 ppm in the late 90s down to 6 ppm today, or down to background levels, basically. So these instruments are just steadily improving, and to the point where for many elements we're getting down now to detection limits there in background level range for that you commonly would see in soils. So the instruments are just steadily improving, technically. All right. That's gist of the presentation for this afternoon, and I think, Steve, you had said there were some questions that have been piling up, so if people have questions they'd like to ask, be happy to field those at this point in time for the last couple minutes.
Yeah, Bob, we got a number that have piled up in the queue. We'll get to as many of them as we can, and then we'll try to address some others Thursday. In the first 30 minutes of Thursday's session, Dina will be talking about representativeness. The first one, are there certain instances or circumstances where XRF can be used for risk assessment and when it can be not? My answer to that would be it depends on your risk assessor. Jokingly, but I think Bob covered that significantly with the slides that talked about the difference between, you know, four samples versus a much higher density XRF in terms of, you know, getting an average concentration or exposure point concentration. I think Bob hit on that, but Bob, do you have anything else you want to mention on that?
Just a couple points. First of all, whether an XRF can be used for risk assessment purposes is very much element specific. For some elements, it is very, very quantitative and very precise. For others, it's not. And so that depends on what element you have an interest in. The second point is its acceptability for risk assessment purposes, as Steve alluded to, is very much regulator specific. So that's just a reality. The third point, though, is because an XRF is so cheap to deploy and data acquisition is so cheap relative to off-site laboratory, for the same budget, you can generate a lot more data with an XRF spatially than you can with discrete sample off-site analytics combination. Dina's going to touch on this in subsequent modules, but the main thing that drives errors in risk assessments is variability or heterogeneity that's present in an exposure unit and the limited number of samples that one's able to collect to address that variability. And XRF, given its cheapness in terms of deployment costs, allows you to increase the number of samples you collect and allows you to address that head-on. So again, an individual XRF measurement may not be as precise as a lab result, but given the fact that you can generate a lot more XRF measurements than you can lab data, you might end up with a much better estimate for the actual average concentration that's present in an exposure unit.
Okay.
That'd be my answer.
Next question. In regards to underreporting, does it matter if it's a prepared sample, through a bag sample, or in situ?
Yeah, you know, that's a wonderful question. And so, in situ, what you have to be aware of with in situ is you're only seeing the top thin layer of soil. Let's say that your decision unit or exposure unit includes an area with a depth down to 6 inches, and you're interested in what the average concentration is over that vertical profile for a given area. If there's any concern at all that your contamination might be buried on the one hand, or on the other hand, maybe it's just superficially deposited and underneath the top quarter inch, there's nothing there, doing an in-situ measurement is going to give you skewed data sets. You'll either underreport the amount of metals present or they'll overreport it. So that's a significant concern for in-situ measurements. The interesting thing about bag samples is it's been our experience of taking measurements through bag samples and that if you take a bunch of measurements through a bag sample, you can take the average of those measurements and actually get an excellent estimate of the average concentration in that bag without a lot of sample prep. And we have not found any evidence of significant underestimation or overestimation for metals that we've looked at in that kind of context. So in a sample that's unprepared, where you're pulling out a cup sample and doing an XRF measurement, that's a crapshoot. 50% of the time, your XRF is likely to underreport what's in that sample. 50% of the time, it's likely to overreport, simply because of the heterogeneity that's present in the sample.
And I think Dina will touch on that again on this Thursday and next Monday with the representativeness piece as well.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
Next question. If only looking for lead, can calibration from the vendor be improved if you leave out other metals?
No. No, you wouldn't.
It's not the same.
Yeah, in fact, you would not want to leave out other metals because it takes into account, I'm not sure how much this is true for lead, but certainly for other elements, it'll take into account the concentrations it's observing for other metals when it's calculating the estimate for the particular element that you have an interest in.
So in other words, the response is there regardless of whether you're looking for the metal or not. The X-rays generated when the electron comes back down out of the higher state back to its original state, you're still going to have those x-rays. You're still going to have a detector response. Yeah. Whether or not you want it to be there isn't, it's not a function of the physical properties of what's going on with the XRF.
There is one thing about the latest XRF that I didn't mention that probably is important from this in this context, and that is the latest XRFs that are tube-based typically come with a set of filters that get applied to the X-rays that are produced by the tube, and those filters have been optimized for particular sets of elements. So, for example, for the latest Niton unit, if you wanted to do an analysis that included all the elements that it's been calibrated for, you would have to run all three filters that come with that instrument. If, on the other hand, you just had an interest in lead, you could just use the filter for lead and ignore the other two filters and get the same quality lead result at a third of the acquisition time. So the longer answer to the question is while it doesn't make a difference from a calibration perspective, it does make a difference from the way the XRF is deployed. And that if you know you're only looking for one element, such as lead, you would deploy it differently than if you were looking for a broader suite of elements.
And in fact, there are instruments that are essentially set up for lead, the lead and paint instruments.
Yes, there are some instruments that are specifically set up for that.
Right. Okay, next question. Are there measurement issues with the soil matrix and physical characteristics of the spike calibration samples that are different or very different from the in-situ being tested?
Absolutely. We had a case, maybe 2 years ago, where we had, in this particular case, it was an Innovax unit. We were looking for uranium. We had several prepared spike samples that we were using for calibration purposes. One of those was a very finely ground powdery material that was spiked with uranium, and the other was a material that was more representative of, say, what you'd expect from a loamy kind of soil. We could not get that instrument calibrated for both standards. In other words, the matrix effects were significant enough between those two samples that either we could calibrate it for the fine powder or we could calibrate it for the more comparable type of matrix, but not both at the same time. And the difference was about 30%, you know, in the way the calibration went. So, in fact, you have to be careful if you get a spike sample that the matrix that's been spiked is approximately representative of what you'd expect to find when you're out in the field. So one workaround there is if you're looking at a site where you have historical samples, if you have a historical sample that's been well characterized, you could use that potentially as a calibration check or as a point of calibration rather than using a spike sample and there are vendors who will give you spike samples, but that's one of the advantages of using an on-site historical sample.
Okay. One of the comments we got is that there's an acoustic loop going on. So what we're going to try to do is, you know, answer as many of these as we can today. We'll try to answer some more on Thursday. And also, I think we're going to try to compile these answers and then type up some written, or compile these questions and type up some written answers to these so that we can get that out to folks. Hopefully that'll help. We've got a little under 5 minutes left. We'll just try to continue to answer as many of these as we can. An additional one, is regression transformation always inappropriate?
I'm not exactly sure what's meant by regression transformation. Sometimes, so I'm going to answer the question in the way that I think it was meant to be put. If you look at Method 6200, it recommends transforming your data. Typically, it's done through a log transform to try to make the data homostochastic. And that is one thing that can be done. Although, if you look at most data sets that get generated from environmental data, a log transform doesn't necessarily make the data more homostochastic, or it may help a little bit, but doesn't help completely. So the short answer is transforming the data is not necessarily a bad thing, but you have to be careful then once you create your regression line and how you interpret the data that you're in the regression that you're working with. So it helps with addressing heteroscedasticity, but it complicates the analysis of the analysis of your interpretation of the regression line. Other questions?
Yeah, I'm going to go down the list a little bit. What is the preferred method to verify field XRF data? ICP analysis or laboratory XRF, and why?
That's a good question. I think if I had my druthers, I'd do both, but usually people don't have the budget to do both. So the short answer to that would be a limited budget, you'd do ICP, simply because you'd want to know if there's a systematic difference between what your XRF is reporting and what the ICP analysis from a lab is reporting. All right. And then once knowing that, you might want to take it a step further and try to figure out why that is. Is it an extraction problem at the lab? Is there something going on with your XRF unit? But given the fact that off-site ICP is usually considered to be the gold standard for decision-making purposes, that would be your point of reference that you'd want to compare with your XRF against.
I think there's another question here that I think plays along that lines regarding the y-intercept and why we often see the positive value there. Our regression analysis with XRF seem to have a y-intercept of around 10 ppm. Does this indicate that XRF detects some fraction that lab methods miss because of the extraction procedure?
That would certainly be one interpretation of a y-intercept. The other reality, though, and you'll see this if you play with data in a regression analysis at all, you drop a data point here, you drop a data point there, and you'll see that y-intercept flop around. So the question really is that 10 ppm y-intercept estimate, how good is that? Is that significantly different than zero, for example? And I think if you saw a 10 ppm y-intercept, I think that is not so different from zero that it's not just part of the noise of doing the regression analysis. But certainly if you have a positive y-intercept, one interpretation of it is an extraction issue with a lab.
Yeah, we have two regarding moisture, and I'll actually talk a little bit about this too in the QC modules coming up, but how should moisture content be examined when doing a comparability evaluation?
Yeah, you know, moisture is an interesting one. The rule of thumb with 6200 is that as long as you're less than 20% soil moisture is not a big deal. The actual reality of the matter, though, is that soil moisture and its effects are element-specific. And the general rule of thumb is the lighter the element is that you have an interest in, the more of an effect moisture content will have on your XRF measurement. There's an easy way of checking for moisture content issues, and that is very simply to take a sample from your site that has a contamination, preferably at the level that would be approximate to your action level, drying that sample, taking XRF or a set of XRF measurements on it, and then slowly rewetting it. And then between rewetting, redo your XRF analyses. And by doing that, you're going to generate a curve that basically tells you what the relationship is between your XRF element-specific responses as a function of soil moisture. And you can determine fairly cheaply and quickly whether soil moisture is going to be concerned for your particular application or setting or whether it's not. And if there's any concerns at all about soil moisture, I would strongly recommend doing that. It's not an expensive thing to do. It's fairly straightforward. It's fairly easy to do. And it'll pretty much tell you what's going on with your instrument and your soils. As I wanted to add a thought. So what effect does soil moisture have? As soil moisture content increases, typically what you see is the concentration that an XRF reports decreases. So soil moisture has the effect of resulting in an XRF underestimating how much concentration is present.
Okay, we're at 3:00. We've got 5 or 6 very interesting questions that we will try to develop some answers for and discuss on Thursday's session starting right at 1:00. We'll pick up on the answers to these additional questions, and then we'll jump into Dina's portion on representativeness. I just wanted to let everyone know, if you advance to slide 242, there are links to additional resources and a feedback form, and we would really encourage the feedback. It helps us to try to hone in on who our audience is and the types of additional questions you might have, and we would really appreciate the feedback to help us get this course online with the audience that we're seeing. So again, thanks everyone, and hopefully we'll see you at additional seminars this August, and the next one again is this Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Thanks.